Thank you everybody for coming. Thank you for joining us for another one of our grand guest speakers. Baruch Hashem, it's beautiful to have so many people learning with us every single night. Can't even hear yourself think or talk some nights. Baruch Hashem, there's so much Torah learning happening in SBM. Rabbi Leibowitz is Shemo Holech Lefanav. There are people who don't even know who he is, who listen to his shiurim and benefit from his Torah all over the world. And it's not an exaggeration, literally all over the world. And I can tell you just that Rabbi Esterelli said last year that the nights that Rabbi Leibowitz is not here in person, physically, he is here on our phones as we listen to his shiurim, and now he is Baruch Hashem here with us to share some Divrei Torah. My own personal addition to that is that I drive a lot to get to SBM. I have a lot of traffic right now on the way back to Manhattan, thanks to all the construction and random things. I consume a lot of shiurim, go through a lot of different speakers from all over the spectrum. And I can tell you that very few people, I also do a lot of editing, very few people truly understand the mechanics of Sefaradi Halakha, especially the Sefarim Rav Avadia. I think people think it's very easy. You open it, you Omer, you look at the Maskana, and you're done. Rabbi Leibowitz is one of the few in the world of the great Ashkenazi popular halachic speakers who truly can present to you what it is, Da'at Maran, Da'at Rav Avadia. Not that he's necessarily going to do that right now, but you should appreciate everything he says, in particular because he has these skills to pick up Svarim, present their Torah, and share the Halakha with Am Yisrael. Thank you, Rabbi Leibowitz.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Rabbi Javahari. It's so great to be back with you again to learn Torah together this evening. Please excuse my Ashkenazis Havara. Whenever I try to fake it, it's a disaster. I end up going back and forth and saying everything wrong. So I'm Ashkenazi. I'm just going Ashkenazis over here, so I apologize. But it's less insulting to you, I think, than when I botched Sparadit. So what Rabbi Javahari suggested we do this evening is what I call the From the Rabbi's Desk Shir, which is essentially I try to share with the Chevra some of the questions that people ask, some of the Shailos LaHalacha that people have asked me recently, and I'll raise three different questions that I got over the course of the past week or so. And if it was a slow week, then the questions aren't so exciting. If it's a more exciting week, the questions are somewhat exciting. This was an average week. And you'll tell me which one of these questions you want to talk about. I'm not going to force anybody into anything. And this way, you'll choose the topic. So if you don't like the topic, it's your fault. It's not my fault, because you're going to be the ones choosing the topic. So here are the shailas that came up this week. On Erev Shabbos last week, I got a text from a rabbi in Chicago, and he writes, a shaila I'm dealing with that I'm not comfortable pasking my own is the following. It's a lifnei iver question, he says. A family here has a daughter with special needs, and they're looking for Shabbos help, which is very hard to find. They found a young woman who is excellent, but she is Jewish and not religious. The question is, she would have to drive on Shabbos in order to get to their house to care for their daughter who has special needs. And while they might be able to get around that issue by scheduling Uber rides, but she might be Mechal Shabbos while she's in the house, and she's very likely going to be Mechal Shabbos while she's in the house. Is that a concern for them? So a double concern. First of all, how do they get her there and back? She's a Jewish person, and to get there and back will involve some level of Chil Shabbos. And second of all, once she's in the house, she'll probably continue to be Mechal Shabbos. So you wanted to know if they, but at the same time, they need someone to care for their daughter. It's not easy. They need help, and it's not easy to find proper help. So is that enough of a shasat chak to come up with some sort of way to make this work? A second shaila I got last Friday morning after davening in my shul, a fellow came over to me and he told me that he does something called Partners in Torah. Anyone with a show of hands heard of Partners in Torah? Just to know. Okay, so let me tell you what Partners in Torah is. For those who don't know, Partners in Torah is this wonderful organization where they find Jewish people who never had an opportunity really to learn Torah, never really were exposed to it, who are interested, who express some interest in learning. Not in religion, not in observance, not in Shabbos kashrus, or anything like that, just learning. And they set them up to learn one-on-one over the phone, over a Zoom, or whatever, sometimes even in person, but usually not. Usually it's over the phone or over a Zoom with someone who's religious, with someone who knows what it is to learn. And usually they'll learn Chumash Rashi, they'll learn Pirkei Avos, they'll learn whatever, you know, and sometimes as it progresses, they'll learn different things. It's a really, really wonderful organization. You also, you never know who you're going to get. I was, it's meant to have like, you know, people like you who you don't even realize how much Torah you know, who probably feel like, some people feel like, people like me and you and like the people in my shul and the people in, you know, in YU and in DRS and all the places that I've been, that who very often feel like, what do I have to offer? How am I going to be able to teach Torah? And we don't realize what growing up in a frum community and what going to a yeshiva for 12 years, how much information is inside of us and how much we have to be able to share with someone who really doesn't know anything. It's like they say in the name of I've heard a video of the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zichron Levracha saying this, and of Noach Weinberg, you say it also, that if you know Aleph, teach Aleph. If you know Beis, teach Beis. Meaning whatever you know, you can teach to somebody else. So it's this organization that sets people up to learn. I was talking recently, not that long ago, so mostly it's meant for like, you know, doctors, lawyers, nursing home people, or whatever other four jobs Orthodox Jews do, you know, that are just have an opportunity to learn with somebody. But I was talking recently to Rabbi Yisrael Kamenetsky, who's one of the premier mechanchim in the world today. He's the Rosh Yeshiva of Halb, of DRS, and he's one of the great, I mean, as far as I can tell, the greatest mechanich I've ever met, but certainly on everybody's list of one of the greatest mechanichim. And he was telling me, oh yeah, the guy I do partners in Torah with. I'm like, you do partners? Like, can you imagine? Like, someone signs up to partners in Torah and they get the greatest mechanich in the country is teaching them, is learning with them, the chavrusa. It's like, I should have signed up for partners in Torah. I'd get a chavrusa with Rabbi Kamenetsky. But he does, yeah, he does partners in Torah. So anyway, so this fellow came over to me, a fellow from Eshul and from Daf Yomi Shir, and he came over and he said that he does partners in Torah, and he said, the person I learn with is a B-list celebrity. That's what he referred to the person as. A B-list celebrity. By a show of hands, how many of you know what that means? A B-list celebrity? Don't be shy. Yeah, so I wasn't sure exactly like what a B-list... When I was a kid, and, you know, everyone had televisions as opposed to, you know, these devices where you could just watch whatever you want. A B-list celebrity meant someone who had a television show that was, like, not on one of the major networks. It was, like, on Channel 9 or Channel 11, but you guys don't even know what I'm talking about. But, you know, in the old days, that's what a B-list celebrity used to mean. Now, a B-list celebrity is, you know, someone who, I don't know, who documents their, you know, their breakfasts on, you know, on Instagram every day or something like that. Right, and has people that watch it or something like that. But whatever it is, my brother, who doesn't know from this, asked me, B-list celebrity, does that mean someone, like when you watch a movie and there are people that are actually acting and talking and then there are other people walking by, like the people that are walking by, I'm like, no, that's extras. That's not a B-list, that's not a celebrity at all. So anyway, he said that the person he learns with is a woman who is a B-list celebrity. He didn't identify this this woman, he just said it's a woman who's a B-list celebrity. Tell you the truth, I was a little bit surprised that they have men learning with women. I didn't know that they do that, but be that as it may, the woman that he learns with told him that there is an Orthodox Jew, there is a otherwise from person who stole millions of dollars from her. Now this woman is not religious at all, other than the fact that she has a partner in Torah. She's married to a Catholic guy, she observes nothing, but she learns once a week with somebody on the phone, and she said that she told her partner in Torah that there is this guy that has stolen millions of dollars from her. And she said that she's scheduled to appear on a podcast next week to talk about that experience. And she's questioning whether she's permitted to do so. And she said the reason she agreed to do it was because she thinks people need to be warned about this guy, that he's dishonest in business. He's gonna, if you get involved with him, he's gonna steal your money. And she thought that it would be important to go and talk about this. But I guess they were learning something about Lashon Hara. And she said, oh wait, there's a thing called Lashon Hara? Is this a problem for me? Am I not allowed to do this? So that is Shaila number two. So the Shaila is not really, is she allowed to do it, although that's part of it. The Shaila is also, to what extent should the partner in Torah you know, be pushing, and how should he, what should he say, what should he not say, in terms of encouraging or discouraging her, as far as that's concerned. A third shaila that came up recently is, I received a text from somebody that says as follows. I have a talis with tcheles on it, which I'm told Rav Shechter, when he spoke here, spoke about tcheles, so everyone's sufficiently familiar with the sugya of tcheles. So the guy says, I have a talis with tcheles on it that was from a pack that I took from someone else's house. And then he put in parentheses, I stole it when I was a teenager. Meaning, as a teenager, he was in someone's house, he saw a pack of tcheles, he said, oh, cool. And he pocketed it, and he took it. He stole it from someone else's house. In recent years, I haven't worn the talis. But even more recently, I sheepishly confessed to the individual about the stolen strings, and I gave him back a new pack of tcheles strings as a replacement. He had no idea about this back then or now, and he said he forgave me, and he accepted the new strings. What can should be done with this talis, with the original strings on it? Can it still be used, either as it is now with the strings on it, or with those removed and new ones added? Meaning, is this talis puzzle, or is it a talis that's kosher to use? He literally stole the tcheles strings that are on the talis. So that is shaila number three. So again, just to remind ourselves, shaila number one was the Jewish babysitter driving at Shabbos. Shaila number two was the B-list celebrities Lashon Hara. And shaila number three was the stolen tcheles. So just maybe take a moment to think in your mind which of those you'd like to speak about, because we're about to take a poll, and I'll and Rabbi Javahari will count when we take the poll. So all those who would like to talk about a Jewish babysitter driving on Shabbos, please raise your hand.
I have a better view.
Okay. All those who want to talk about the next one, B-list Lashon Hara. And that's pretty even. And all those who want to talk about the stolen tcheles. It's like pretty even, right? What do I do? You think? Do you now? That's okay. What do I do? Okay.
What do I do in these situations?
Normally, like, there's one person who I can, you know. Should we actually count? One more time? One more vote? All those who want shout number one about the Jewish babysitter driving on Shabbos? Okay. Keep him up. B-list Lashon Hara? I think it's a little more. I think B is what, right? That's it, yeah. Okay, so, oh, and you changed your vote also. Okay, so, yes, and the third one, I wasn't going to win. Okay. Although, by the way, between me and you, that was the best shaila of all. So, okay. Yeah, in terms of, like, the halachic sugya involved, it's a fascinating, fascinating sugya. I'll tell you one more shaila that relates to that one before we get to the B-list Lashon Hara one. There's a tshuva in the Stipler. The Stipler was, nowadays he's known as the father of Rav Chaim Kanievsky, but it used to be Rav Chaim Kanievsky was known as the Stipler's son. Stipler was the brother-in-law of the Chazon Ish, an Adam Gadol Ad Me'od, and he wrote a series of svarim called Kilos Yaakov. There is some beautiful stories about when Rav Shechter went to meet the Stipler. Some of them are even true. And the Stipler did not write halachic tshuvas in general. He wrote about Gemara, sugyas in Gemara. He has in one section of Masechta Sukkah a halachic tshuva, and he concludes it with a tefillah that he should be zochah to the siyata d'shmaya to paskin correctly. And the shaila was very similar to that third shaila. The shaila was, there was a sofer who was writing a mezuzah, and the sofer, you know, he has to take his quill and stick it into an inkwell in order to have the ink to write. And he ran out of ink in his inkwell, but his friend was writing near him, and his friend was in the bathroom or whatever, wasn't there. So he stuck his pen into his friend's inkwell without permission, wrote a few letters with that, and then finished the mezuzah. And then he later found out that the friend is very makbid, and he does not allow people to steal his ink. So he asked for mechila afterwards, and the guy said, "Amochel, it's no problem." Question is the mezuzah kosher? Right, so it's a very similar shayla to the stolen tcheila shayla, but again, not for now. Okay.
You're not supposed to mix ink. If I'm using one ink, using another one, my feather contaminates his ink. So it's
That what?
He doesn't want it to be contaminated.
Okay, for whatever reason he's makpid, but he was makpid. And then he was mochel afterwards, after the mezuzah was ready written. Okay. So anyway, but we're not talking about that. So let's get to the Lashon Hara Shaila. So what exactly is the issue over here? Meaning, isn't it obvious that you're not allowed to speak Lashon Hara? Well, Lashon Hara, Lamed Hei, spell it backwards, that's where you'll say whatever, isn't it obvious you're not allowed to speak Lashon Hara? Is it ever mutter to speak Lashon Hara? So most of the Sefer Chafetz Chaim is really about when it's mutter to speak Lashon Hara. Meaning, it's first about how terribly usher it is, and then like a lot about what the exceptions are, when it's actually mutter. And if you learn through all of the cases that it's mutter, and all of the rules for what makes Lashon Hara mutter, it's very, very limited. And you get to very few cases that are mutter. But one of the broader heterim that we have for Lashon Hara is when something is for a toelas, when there is some constructive purpose to the Lashon Hara. This woman says she's speaking Lashon Hara because there is a constructive purpose to it, because she's going to save other people from being taken advantage of her financially the way she was. And I'll tell you another case. I forgot to mention. It's almost the same Shaila. Last week I got a phone call from an old friend of mine, a Talmud Chaver of mine, who does a podcast. He hosts a podcast. And his podcast is all about people who've overcome different kinds of adversity in their lives. The host himself has overcome some very significant adversity in his life, and he interviews other people that have overcome different types of adversity, and they've learned to roll with the punches in living their lives. And he said that one of the people that he was interviewing recently was talking about, I don't know if they're a survivor of abuse, of trauma, of whatever, but it's a known family in the community that they're from, a very known, well-known religious family. And as the person was telling his story of everything he went through, he started talking about how his father was abusive emotionally and verbally and physically or whatever, and how his father was always getting drunk and this and that. And he started to, because that was part of his story. And for him, it's cathartic. For him, it's part of his healing process to be able to share his story and to be able to, and the person who hosts the podcast happens to be a licensed therapist, and they know how to respond and how to see, what to say to the person. But he said, can I air such a podcast? Can I put such a podcast online where everybody's going to be able to listen and they're going to hear that this neighbor of theirs, who they know, who they sit next to in shul, how he was abusive and he was always getting drunk and he was... So are they allowed to air such a thing? It's a toelas, because the person finds every single person he's interviewed has called him back afterwards and said, this was such a cathartic experience. It was so good for my emotional health. It was so helpful to me to get to where I am and to become better and to self-improvement. B'chule, b'chule. So there is some toelas. So can you just like blanket say, it's toelas, so it's going to be mutter, so it's going to be permissible because of the cathartic experience. So let's maybe take a step back and talk about other situations of Lashon Hara where it may or may not be mutter. A common question that comes up is whether a husband and a wife are allowed to share Lashon Hara. Meaning, on the one hand, what do you think? Husband or wife, can a husband tell a wife Lashon Hara about somebody else, some good juicy gossip? So you would think, well, machlokes is always the answer, right? But logically, what would you say? No. So let's not call it Lashon Hara. Let's say a woman was at work and her boss was like terribly mean to her that day. And everything went wrong, and when the boss should have been understanding, the boss wasn't, and she's very frustrated, and she comes into the house, and she's in a bad mood, and the husband says, what's wrong? Is she allowed to say, well, I just had such a bad day, because my boss was really mean to me, and I thought I was going to lose my job, because he did this, and I thought I had messed up, and he wasn't understanding at all. Is she allowed to do that? So, but I thought everyone just said she's not allowed to speak Lashon Hara. And now that I've defined the Lashon Hara for you, all of a sudden, meaning all I said, my boss was mean. If I were to say, am I allowed to go over to you and tell you, by the way, Rabbi Javahari, he's so mean to me, right? Like, am I allowed to say that? Of course I'm not allowed to say that. That's Lashon Hara. So why is she allowed to say that her boss was mean to her? I mean, why would you think that that would be okay? So this is a machlokas. It's a major sugya. The Chafetz Chaim writes in Hilchos Lashon Hara. And by the way, of all the, it's been pointed out by people far greater than me that of all of the Chafetz Chaim's many, many achievements, and he has many, many achievements, there is probably no greater achievement than writing the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. The fact that he wrote a Mishnah Brura is very impressive. Very impressive. But he had a lot to work with, because the Mishnah Brura is condensing all of the existing commentaries on Shulchan Aruch and putting it into one readable unit. And that's very, very impressive to be able to do that. He had some help from family members, but it's very, very impressive. Hilchos Lashon Hara is even more impressive, because where is Hilchos Lashon Hara? Where is the Masechta that talks about Lashon Hara? Where is the Sefer that came before the Chafetz Chaim that collected commentaries on Lashon Hara? Like, you have a Shulchan Aruch that has Nosei Kelim, and in the back you have things, and you have all sorts of Svarim that were written on the Shulchan Aruch to look at. Where was the topic of Lashon Hara? You know where it was? There was a couple of Dapim Maseches Arachin. There was like a half, there was like 10 lines in Maseches Psachim. There was a few, sections of Shari Tshuva the Rabbeinu Yonah. There's and the Chafetz Chaim managed to collect from all over the place and to make a topic, and to, meaning it existed, but people wouldn't have noticed it without the Chafetz Chaim pointing out where it all came from. So it's hard to imagine too many greater accomplishments. Well, maybe the fact that he created a Rav Elchanan Wasserman is also a great accomplishment. He is to have a Talmud like Rav Elchanan was also. They say when the Chafetz Chaim wanted to leave Eretz Yisrael, they said you can't leave, because who's gonna lead us? And he said, you have Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Meaning that was he said, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, as a married person, do not try this at home. Rav Elchanan Wasserman, as a married person, used to leave his wife and family for the entire Chodesh Elul every year to spend in Radin with the Chafetz Chaim. He would go back to yeshiva to Radin to spend the entire Chodesh Elul with the Chafetz Chaim. One year, the Chafetz Chaim gave a Musar Shmuz in the yeshiva in Radin, and one of the Bachrim said, he gave the same Shmuz last year. And Rav Elchanan said, no, he said 8 new words this year that he didn't say last year. There were 8 more words in the Musar Shmuz. I mean, that kind of a Talmud of the Chafetz Chaim. But anyway, his great accomplishment, certainly one of his great accomplishments, was writing the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. And in that Sefer Chafetz Chaim, he writes, Ein shum chilek b'isra sibor beinim hu mesaper la'anashim acherim krovav o'rechokav ol ishto imloshu davar shetzarech lo'diyah mepnei ha'to'eles shetiyah mizah ala haba. There's no distinction who you're telling Lashon Hara to, whether it's your wife, whether it's anybody else, whether it's a relative, or it doesn't make a difference. And then he goes on to include warning people about people who may be untrustworthy as part of the toelis, meaning if there is a benefit for the future. So he says, if there's somebody that's untrustworthy that you know might take advantage of your wife, you know that your wife is going shopping tomorrow, and you know that there's a storekeeper in the neighborhood who's a ganav and is going to take advantage of her, so you can say, you know, don't go to that store because this is an untrustworthy person. That is a toelis. But to stop saying my boss was mean to me, that's not a toelis. L'chora, says the Chafetz Chaim. Now, how does he know that it's a toelis to prevent someone from taking advantage of you? So he brings a raya, because again, this is Chafetz Chaim's amazing ability to draw from everywhere. He brings a raya from a Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara in Kiddushin says that after Rabbi Meir died, the Tana, the holy Tana, Rabbi Meir, a lot of the Talmidim wanted to go learn in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yehuda. And Rabbi Yehuda warned his Talmidim, and he said to his Talmidim, Al yichnusu Talmidei Rabbi Meir lekan. Do not allow the Talmidim of Rabbi Meir to enter into our yeshiva. They're just coming to show that I don't know anything. They're coming to try to outsmart me. They're not coming to learn. They're coming to show. You know, in yeshivas, there's this thing that everyone believes that they have the derech halimud, and anyone who learns differently from them just doesn't know what they're doing. That they're just fumbling around in the dark. But there's only my Rebbe knows how to learn as a proper derech halimud. I'd always be very suspicious of someone who thinks that they have the only derech halimud. So he says, don't let them in. They're just coming to show me that my whole way of learning is wrong, and they're just coming to, so don't let them in. Says Chafetz Chaim, how's Rabbi Yehuda allowed to tell his Talmidim that? That's Lashon Hara. He's speaking badly about all of Rabbi Meir's Talmidim. Says Chafetz Chaim, because he's trying to protect them. And if you're trying to protect someone who's going to be untrustworthy, that's a valid toelis. However, he warns, Rabbi Mishtapshin Bazem. Many people make a mistake. Shemisaprim Lenashosem Kolmashi Irelem Imploni Uploni Bebesa Medrishal Bishuk. There are so many husbands that come home, and because, you know, you're supposed to talk to your wife, make conversation. So the way he makes conversation is, oh, this guy in the Beis Medrash today asked the stupidest question, or this one started picking a fight with me, I wasn't even in his way and he shoved me out of the way, or this one did this to me, or in the Shuk, you know, where that one cut me in line when I was about to get on, I was going to be the last, there was room for one more person in the elevator, I was going to be the last one, this guy just jumps in front of me and jumps in the elevator and then goes as the doors are closing, you know, like he's whatever he wants to tell. Of what happened that day. He said, a lot of people make this mistake. He says, V'inei, Milvadis Roloshon Hara, Od Hu Marva Bezem Achlokas. He says, you have to realize, Chafetz Chaim is an expert at this, at identifying that when you think you're doing one Avera, in all likelihood, you're doing multiple Averas. It's very rare that you're doing the Avera of Lashon Hara and only Lashon Hara. You're very often, that's the whole Sefer Chafetz Chaim, he tells you how many Isurim there are, that you're really piling up the Isurim. He says, what you're doing is you're being Marba machlokes, ki bevadei titor hasin levitarav avorze imploni yoman shebeso. Because the next time, if you tell your wife about how that guy was mean to you, next time your wife sees that guy's wife, she's going to be a little more aggressive toward that guy's wife and say, you know, what's your husband's problem? You know, are you just like your husband? You're cutting me in line in the, you know, in the store, just like your husband cut my husband in line in the Beis Medrash or whatever to try to talk to the Rebbe or whatever. You know, whatever it's going to be, she's going to be. It's the gam to lelech od velariv. And not only that, a spouse is going to want to protect their spouse. Don't be a shmata. That's an expression. I don't know if the Shvarim use that expression. I think it's a Yiddish word, right? Don't be a doormat. Don't let people walk all over you. You got to fight. You have to stand up for yourself. And she's going to push him, says Chafetz Chaim, into being marba machlokas. And ultimately, he's going to go down a road that he doesn't want to go down, all because he decided that he has to tell that Lashon Hara to his wife. I'll tell you that I have a dear friend, Rabbi Chaim Marcus, who's a Rav in Springfield, New Jersey. And he comes from a rabbinic family. His brothers are all rabbis. His father was the rabbi of the Yom Kippur of Staten Island, which at the time was, I think, the largest shul in America. And he said that when he went into Rabbanus, when he took the job at his shul, his father warned him not to share all the problems that he has with the Balabatim with his wife. Because he said, you'll ultimately forgive the people that that do something not nice to you. She won't. She'll never forgive them. So don't share that. You don't have to. You're not supposed to share those things. It's very, very sound advice. It's really based on Avos Rabbi Nassim. You know, the Avos Rabbi Nassim says that when the Mishnah says Al Tar B'Sicha Ni'isha, that's what it's talking about. That it's talking about not going through the problems you have with everybody else and what they did to you. And the truth is, Lashon Hara includes sometimes even non-negative speech. Even if it's just something that's going to promote negativity, but in your mind it's not negative. It could be a violation of rechilus. Even if you're saying something positive, it can cause harm. If you say it to an enemy, even when saying something inherently positive, you can't have negative intentions. Like when Doeg saying that Achimelech gave David a sword and food, which Achimelech would have freely admitted to because it's a great mitzvah, but because he thought David was working for Shaul, but with negative intentions, it could do great damage. Now, so typically speaking, there is this idea that Lashon Hara applies to everybody. It applies even when you're talking to your closest people. What about, though, is there any exception for unloading? Meaning for a person to just, sometimes you bottle things up and you end up becoming either unstable or easily agitated because you just have too much that you're holding inside of you. Right? Very often that happens. And a person needs to have an avenue to be able to share, to be able to speak. Right? Whether it be a therapist, whether it be a Rebbe, whether it be a spouse. And sometimes a spouse serves as a therapist. Obviously, if a person really needs therapy, you go to a trained therapist. But on the very basic level, on the day-to-day frustrations, you go to a spouse first. That's typically where a person goes with those frustrations that they're bottling up inside and that they need to share with somebody. Or you go to a very close friend, or you go to a parent, or you go to a sibling, someone that you feel very, very close to share those things. It's a very important thing, by the way, while I'm on the topic, to have such people in your lives. And it's very important to have different types of relationships in your lives. Meaning, we all know that there's a difference between a relationship you have with your parent versus a sibling, let's say, or a friend versus a parent. Those are different kinds of relationships, and each one is very valuable. One of the relationships that people sometimes don't put enough stock into is a relationship with a Rebbe. For a person to have a Rav, a Rebbe, someone that they know, that they admire, that's Kamal Hashem Tzvakos, that they can also seek guidance from on a consistent basis, someone that they can connect to. And it's not that, oh, I don't need it because I have a spouse, I have a sibling, I have a parent, I have so many good friends. Those are all great and all important to have. But just like you can't say, I don't need friends because I have a Rebbe, a person shouldn't say, I don't need a Rebbe because I have friends. Meaning it's important that we have all of these different kinds of relationships. And there is this concept that if a person is bottling something up inside, they do need to share it with other people. The Gemara tells us, the Pasuk rather tells us, the Gemara interprets it, but the Pasuk tells us in Mishlei, Daga Belevish, Yashichena, that if a person has daga in his heart, so yasichena or yashichena, that's the question in the Gemara. The Gemara has two understandings, that chalamer yasichena midaita, yashichena midaita, v'chalamer yasichena la'achevin. That one opinion says that what's the advice, that if you have daga, you have worry, you have something that you're holding up inside of you, one bit of advice is just push it out of your mind, and the other bit of advice is share it with other people. So which is it? What are you supposed to do? So pashtus is that... that sometimes, you know, for some people it's more helpful to push it out of their mind, and for some people it's more helpful to share. It doesn't always cut along these lines, but very often for at least for the minor frustrations of life, certainly for things that are major, again, speak to a therapist, speak to someone, and you have to, you know, but for the minor frustrations of life, men very often have an easier time, and again, not every man deals with it the same way, but begadol, men generally have an easier time just focusing on something else. Just like, ignore it, let me focus on something else. Like, okay, my kid smashed up my car last week, Baruch Hashem, everyone's healthy, now I gotta deal with the insurance company. I don't wanna focus on that right now. I'm gonna learn for a little bit, I'm just gonna push that out of my mind. Meaning, minor frustrations in life, you push out of your mind, you focus on something else. Another mahalich, and typically the way many women, if not most women, will deal with it, is that they can't do that. Meaning women are typically, and some men also, and again, this is not, it's not so binary that it's all men in one camp, all women in the other camp, but generally speaking, the way that their brains work is that everything is mingled with each other, that there's no, you know, we can't put things in boxes. And the only way to deal with it is yasichen el acherim, is tell somebody else. It is an important shalom bayis thing. A lot of times, like husband and wife will not understand each other's frustrations or how they're dealing with their frustrations. A wife will come to a husband, you're upset, something happened today, you need to talk about it. And why is she saying you need to talk about it? Because if it were her, she would need to talk about it. He actually does not need to talk about it. That would be the worst thing for him. What he actually needs to do is just focus on something else. What he actually needs to do is just mindlessly, read the newspaper or whatever. Just like do something totally different. Similarly, a lot of times a wife has a certain frustration and she's talking on the phone and she's telling about the frustration that she had with her boss today to her mother and to her sister and to her best friend and to his sister and she's going through the same story over and over and over and over again, and he's like, stop it, just stop it, stop talking about it, it doesn't help to talk about it. Why is he saying that? Because for him, it wouldn't help to talk about it. For her, very often, she needs to talk about it. This is what the Gemara is telling us, that sometimes you have to just put it out of your mind. And for some people, you need to talk about it to other people in order to deal with these issues. A lot of times, if you bottle something up inside, you think you're being a hero by bottling it up inside and not sharing any negativity, but then it builds up so much that it's going to explode one day out of you, and it's going to explode in a way that's much bigger than it should have been and cause much more trouble than it should have been. So the Gemara says sometimes yasichen l'acherim is very important in order to deal with it in the proper way. The Chavetz Chaim writes that it could be that that's called the toelas. He says the efshar duah dinim kavanasul b'sipuro. If your intent in saying it is lahafigas da agasul milibo, is to remove your daaga, your worry, your concern. Havi kimechavin the toelas alahaba. That's the same as having a kavana for a proper toelas, for something that's beneficial in the future. Now. There is an issue to speak Lashon Hara. There's also an issue to listen to Lashon Hara. So, you know, it could be that one spouse needs to unload and the other spouse doesn't have a heter to listen to it. Meaning they may need to share it. But in order for it to be mutter to listen to, the Chafetz Chaim points out, first of all, your intention has to be l'shem shemayim, which means that you're listening to help the other person. You're not listening because of, it's juicy gossip or anything like that. It's just you're trying to help a suffering friend or loved one. Also, it has to be that whatever you're told is for you to hear, not to spread. Meaning, it's not for you to go around telling everybody else what happened. Also, to keep in mind, even as it's being told to you, that you're not really allowed to believe it. Meaning, you have to always keep in mind you're hearing one side of the story, and there's always another side of the story, and you don't tell the person who's unloading to you, by the way, I don't believe you, right? You don't say that, but you have to always keep in mind that there's another person, there's another story, there's another side of the story. They say that Rav Lichtenstein Zichrono Livracha held that perhaps the halachic concept of ishto kegufo reflects a deeper connection between a husband and wife, to the point that sharing with each other is natural, and that that's the norm and the expectation, and that therefore there is a little more leeway in that relationship. And it wasn't only Rav Lichtenstein that held that way. Supposedly his Rebbe, or his, one of his Rebbeim, Rav Huttner, Zichrono Livracha, held the same way. But Moshe Surmach writes that his father had sent a letter to the Chafetz Chaim once asking that Shaila, and the Chafetz Chaim said, no, there's no ishto kegufo when it comes to Lashon Hara. But one could understand that maybe part of being married is to empathize with the other person's struggles, and it's impossible to do if you don't let them talk about their struggles. You know, you sit down to do, they're going to start talking and be like, no, I can't listen, this is Lashon Hara, right? That's not going to work. It's and that's part of being married, is to be able to share and to be able to listen to other people's struggles. Okay, that's about married people, but let's go back to more the core of our Shaila. Our Shaila wasn't about a married person. Our Shaila was about someone going on a podcast that could be listened to by, I don't know, the really popular ones, I don't know what B-list celebrities command, but the popular Jewish podcast probably get tens of thousands of listens. The popular non-Jewish podcast, probably millions of listens. So a B-list celebrity going on some podcast, maybe millions of people are going to listen to it. Is there any heter just because she's talking about a really bad guy? I mean, she's talking about someone who stole millions of dollars from her. This is a really bad person. Are you allowed to speak Lashon Hara about just bad people? About someone who's a Bala Vera? So that is a fascinating discussion as well, because when it comes to an apikores, for example, the Chafetz Chaim writes that if the person is an apikores, mitzvah leganoso levazoso ben bifneim ben shalom bifneim, it's a mitzvah to knock them down a notch and to say not nice things about them and to be mevazah them. For their apikorsis, they are people who are sonei Hashem, who are working against the Ribbono Shel Olam, and you have to stand up for the Ribbono Shel Olam. Okay, but we're not talking about an apikorsis, we're talking about someone who's, he's a very firm person, he believes in all the Ikarei Emunah, he believes that God gave us the Torah, he believes that Mashiach is going to come, he believes in all the Ikarei Emunah, there's only one God, not other gods of the Torah, that we have in the same Torah, I mean, whatever, go through all the Yud Gimel, right, he believes in all 13, right, but he's a bad guy, he's a Rasha. So if a person violates Averos that people clearly know is usser. So if everyone knows that person does averos, because there are constant shmuels ra'os, there are constant rumors about him, let's say he's an adulterer or something like that, then you can consider him a rasha. But if it's a one-time rumor, you're not allowed to believe a one-time rumor. So in Be'er Mayim Chayim, the Chafetz Chaim writes that you can't be mean-spirited, but to the extent that you need to prevent other people from falling into the trap, this person's trap, you're allowed to talk about Balei Averos, but You can't be motivated by hatred. You can't be motivated by trying to bring this person down. You can't exaggerate. And you can't speak ill of him privately, then be machnif him publicly. I mean, he can't be the kind of person where every time you see him, oh, kvod harav, you know, and then behind his back, that guy's a lowlife, and I can't stand him. Like, you can't do that. You have to be consistent in terms of he shouldn't feel that you're treating him in a certain way, that he's your close friend. The Yerushalmi in Maseches Peah is quoted by the Smag that you're allowed to speak Lashon Hara about Balei Machlokas, about people who engage in Machlokas. So there are certain people that are so evil that you're allowed to speak Lashon Hara about them. But here's the catch, and this is like a major catch. Chavetz Chaim says that in order to speak Lashon Hara with Koeles, a person needs to fulfill, depending how you count them, but let's say 7 conditions. So condition number one is that if you had to see the issue yourself. It can't be hearsay. It can't be, oh, someone said that this person is a ganav. No, it has to be that you know, you saw it. They stole the money from you, you saw them steal it. That's condition number one. Okay, this woman might have condition number one, right? That she knows. Condition number two, you have to make sure that it's actually true. Wait a second. Condition number one was that you saw it with your own eyes. So what does that mean? You have to know that it's actually true. If you saw it with your own eyes, don't you know that it's actually true? So there's a thing, you know, that people do sometimes, that we put too much faith in our own eyes. Meaning, a lot of times we believe we know something to be true because we saw something, but we didn't see the whole backstory, and maybe our eyes even deceived us because our eyes really only see what's on the surface. You know, there's a beautiful maisa I just heard on a podcast from David Luchenstein. He said a beautiful maisa in the name of Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson. Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson said that he was talking to a woman who had gone to the Blind Museum in Israel. Anyone been to the Blind Museum in Israel? Never been there. They take you through this whole place. It's dark, not a speck of light anywhere in the place, and you have a blind tour guide leading you through. And they're trying to show you what it's like to live as a blind person. And it's very powerful, very impactful. They don't tell you the tour guide is blind, but now you all know. But at the end of the tour, the tour guide who was leading you the whole time said, oh, by the way, I'm blind. And and there was this woman that was going through the tour in the Blind Museum, and the tour guide was amazing. He was funny and charming and had a silky smooth voice and was, he was amazing. She was like, this guy is great. And then they got to the end and the lights came on and she saw him and he was like the most unattractive person she's ever seen. Pock-faced and overweight and his eyes obviously were not, you know, were difficult to look at. And like he was, and she realized that she was only able to really see him for who he was when she couldn't see him. Because sometimes our eyes give us the impression that we're seeing, and we put a little too much faith in what our eyes are telling us we see when we're not really seeing. You know, we believe that seeing is believing, or we say that seeing is believing, but a lot of times it's not. A lot of times what we see can be very misleading to us. So there are two different tanaim in the Chafetz Chaim. Number one is that it has to be firsthand, so you know that it happened. And number two, you have to make sure it's true. And those are two separate things. Because even if you saw it happen, you're still not sure that it's actually true, that what you think happened is what actually happened. Number three, you also have to first go to the person himself who did the Aveira and confront them about it. Number four, you have to say the story that happened without any exaggeration whatsoever. Not by removing. An exaggeration could be by adding facts or by removing pertinent information. Meaning there may be something that's like a saving grace for the person. You know, to say they were so stressed out because their father was in the hospital the day before and they only got 2 hours sleep the night before, and you just skip that part of the story when you say it. You're not allowed to do that either. You're not allowed to skip a part of the story that might put them in a more positive light. Number five. What do we have to? Your focus and your purpose has to be l'toelas, to be for the person to benefit the person you're telling it to, not because it's so great to talk bad about the person who caused me so much aggravation, and it feels so good to be able to. And you know, it's also really great when people are crowding around and listening to me, and I'm the center of attention, and I'm able to speak. And next, he says, it has to be that there's no other way to solve the problem, that the only way to solve the problem is by speaking Lashon Hara. And finally, he says, the last condition that has to be met is that you have to be sure that you're speaking Lashon Hara, or confident at least, that you're speaking Lashon Hara is not going to cause the person greater damage than what they would deserve in a Beis Din. I mean, if a person stole $1 million from you, you take them to a Beis Din, Beis Din will make them pay $1 million. But if by you speaking Lashon Hara, it's going to cause them to lose $10 million because they're going to lose all their accounts and all their clients and everything else, well, then you're not allowed to do that because Beis Din would not have done that to them. You're not allowed to speak Lashon Hara. That's going to cause them greater damage than otherwise. Now, when you go through all of those criteria, it's very, very difficult to think of a situation where it's actually mutter to speak Lashon Hara, where it's actually going to be okay to speak Lashon Hara. So in these cases, it was a straw man. There was no shiloh over here. Can a woman get on a podcast and speak to millions of people? Can a frum person who, even though they're trying to roll with the punches of life and they're trying to, you know, to overcome adversity and whatever else they've been through, can they go speak about their family and air all the dirty laundry of their family in front of the whole community, in front of thousands of people? Of course not. It doesn't meet nearly all of the criteria of the Chafetz Chaim. Can they go to a therapist and share their problem? Can they go to a Beis Din to try to get their money back? For sure, those things you're allowed to do. But there's a responsible way, and there's a proper way to deal with these situations, and it may not be as gratifying to the person who was wronged. It may take a lot of kochos and nefesh, it may take a lot of discipline and a lot of work to get to that point, to feel that... that you're doing the right thing and to do the right thing, but that's part of being a Jew. Part of being a Jew is to overcome our Yetzer Hara. And I think in terms of this Shiloh, the Bilas Lashon Hara, there's no Shiloh. Of course, she's not allowed to go on the podcast. Now, what should the partner in Torah tell her? So he may want to introduce her to the concept of Lashon Hara, and he may want to tell, you know, he doesn't want to lose her only connection to Torah, so, and especially if she's already committed and she's already committed to go on the show, but you might be able to guide her in terms of how that conversation is going to go. You might be able to limit the damage somewhat. You might be able to just inform her about, you know, the beauty of the halachos of how to speak. And through that conversation, at least when she's not going to back out, she's not committed to the halachic system. So even someone who is committed to the halachic system would have a hard time with this. But she's not going to back out of the interview. It's her big chance to go on this big podcast or whatever. But you can get into her head a little bit and start getting her thinking in a certain way, so that when she's talking, she's going to hopefully at least mitigate the damage that could otherwise be done. So that's what I think is the partner in Torah's responsibility. And really, the mitzvah of tochacha at a certain level really all falls on him, because there's no one else that's going to do it. Usually, you know, if someone does something wrong, it's really my mitzvah. Maybe someone else will do it. Maybe someone else is better positioned to give the mussar. This is her only connection with anybody religious. It's her only connection with anybody who ever heard the words Lashon Hara. So probably he has some responsibility to at least move her in the right direction, even though he knows that he's probably not going to be able to move her entirely. Okay, so that's a little bit about Lashon Hara. Yeah.
What if he knows that their celebrity tells him that I am for sure doing a podcast anyway? Just
want to know if theoretically it's supposed to be allowed. Yeah, so there is a concept in halacha called mutav shiyu shogeg in valyum mezidin, that it's better for a person to be shogeg. And that concept only applies when you're dealing with someone who doesn't know already. If it's someone who does know, meaning if it's like a pasuk that's preferish in the Torah, and the person has learned the Torah and has seen pesukim in the Torah, we don't say mutav shiyu shogeg v'alyum mezidin. So probably you shouldn't go through the whole extent of it, because this meets that criteria. She probably never heard of Lashon Hara before. She probably thinks she's doing a mitzvah. But you might want to tell her that, you know, we do have these limitations on how to do it, like I mentioned before, to try to, you know, to rein her in a little bit. So maybe if she's doing it anyway, and you're not going to be able to tell her not to do it, but you may be able to guide her in how to do it better.
Question to mind. So regarding single shemara and the therapeutic status of a therapist or your friend or a wife, to what extent can somebody go and speak about their events? purely for two of themselves.
Yeah, so I think it's very important, and the therapist needs to know this, but the therapist shouldn't be taking any guilty pleasure in this either. A therapist has to be a professional, and therapists also should realize, and therapists typically are pretty good at this, at least the ones I know, at realizing they're hearing one side of a story, and while they're sympathizing with the client, with the patient, they're not accepting everything that they say automatically as truth. But to the extent that the therapist should guide the conversation, to the extent that the therapist thinks, maybe I should take a step back. I think, and I don't know if this is controversial to say or not, I think it's really, really important that when people go to a therapist that they should try to find a firm therapist. I think from a therapy standpoint, in my experience, again, I have no expertise whatsoever. I just have a lot of talmidim and friends and people that I talk to. From a therapy standpoint, you go to a non-firm therapist, and let's say you're struggling with OCD, and it comes out in the way that you observe Hilchos Shabbos or Hilchos Taras HaMishpach or something. You can end up spending 10 sessions just like describing what Shabbos is. So the therapist may be ready for an exam on Hilchos Shabbos at the end, but they will not have helped you at all because they're just trying to get into your world to be able to understand you. So you will have wasted a lot of time and a lot of money and they still won't get it because they haven't been part of your life experience. So as much as they try, because that's their job, to try to get into your world, it's very, very helpful. It's also helpful because they know your own religious sensitivities, meaning they know what they can and cannot encourage you to do. Sometimes when people are dealing with issues relating to sexuality and things like that, what a therapist can recommend it clinically based on, by the book versus within the firm community are very different things. And having someone sensitive to Hilchos Lashon Hara, for example, is a very, very important thing. So I think a lot of it is on the therapist to familiarize themselves with what the limits are and to know how to best guide the person. Yeah. So if he's an apikoros, then there's definitely a lot more room to be makel. You don't have all those conditions by the apikoros. The apikoros is the mitzvah of azos and everything else. It's just hard to say that someone actually has the status of apikoros in that sense. Meaning, the chazanish and the benin tzion say that everyone is a tinuk shenishba nowadays. Question to what degree, but we take it pretty broadly that almost everybody is considered to be someone who is just uneducated, didn't know any better. Maybe it is everyone's responsibility to know better, but not everybody does. But it's hard to. She shouldn't be making the determination that that person is not apikoros. I mean, what do you mean? I know that he davens three times a day, but if he could steal that money from me, he obviously doesn't believe there's a God above that's watching him. He's an apikoros. Or he has a yetzer hara for money, like most people do. Meaning, it's very hard to make that determination. Certainly, someone who's no gay abadav shouldn't be making that determination. You can ask questions about other things also, by the way. I probably won't know the answers. But
so I'll probably tell you what you were saying earlier about the equal prohibition on listening to Lashon Hara. Presumably the same criteria would apply. But in that case, why is it that I can, maybe that I can't, but why is it that I can watch Fox News, CNN, whatever I choose to, or read any news at all about Gal Gadot, Netanyahu, etc.
Yeah, the heter that is most often used in media is the heter of apetlasa, that anything that was said in front of X number of people, the whole world already knows about it, and therefore there's limited things that you're adding. Having said that, there are a lot of conditions in that also, and if it's adding a lot of negativity in your life, and there is very limited toelas, you should probably be a little more careful about the kind of news that there is no such thing as news anymore, right? There's only commentary. So we should probably be a little bit more careful about what we consume, especially when it involves Jewish people. To some extent, you need to know what's going on in the world. To some extent, you need to know what to be careful about. You need to know what to vote for. You need to know what to daven for, right? There are things that you need to know, but enochinami, one should be careful about what we consume. What ends up happening, as I'm sure we know, is that even when you use your computer, even like any social media, they're just going to keep feeding you the stuff you like. So if you're of a liberal bend or a conservative bend, so you're only going to see the stuff you like, more or less, or someone making fun of the stuff that you don't like, right? Meaning like it just feeds into this frenzy, which we see is unhealthy. The whole society is unhealthy largely because of that. So yeah, it's a raya to the halacha. That's just a very unhealthy way to live.
So the answer is,
it may just be problematic to overconsume, but to get like basic facts from as unbiased a source as possible, you have to know how to vote. You have to know what you can do. You have to know what to daven for. Like, those are important things. So to know that if this person is the next prime minister of Israel, then I'm concerned that these decisions are going to be made, or that's the path he's going to go down. Even though Lev Malachim Biyad Hashem, I remember we once asked Rav Schechter before one of the major elections, does it really matter who you vote for? And he said, at the end of the day, it doesn't, because the person, the day that they're elected, they lose Bechira Chavshis. They no longer have the right to make their own choices in life, because Lev Malachim Biyad Hashem. But part of Hishtadlus is that you have to vote for the person that it would make, that would take the least miracle, in order for things to work out. So at the end of the day, that's part of Hishtadlus. That's part of what we have to do. But yeah, one should be careful about what we consume in terms of media. Yeah, I think so. So what were they again?
The Jewish non-religious housekeeper.
The Jewish non-religious... Okay, so let's go with the tzitzis one first. So just very quickly, the tzitzis one is a suffix in Bir Halacha. Bir Halacha and Simon Yud Aleph raises this exact suffix, that if you have stolen tzitzis, stolen strings that you put on a baguette, and then the person is mochel afterwards, is that tzitzis kosher or not? He says, tzarchim gadol, he's not sure. Having said that, many, many poskim, including the Stipler and Kilis Yaakov and Rav Shlomo Kluger and the Emek Baracha, many, many poskim don't understand why he's confused by this, why he thinks it's Sarachi and Gadol, and they say that it's Pashut, that it's Mutter. Why is a fascinating sugya, but how Tasav Lomanasui applies or doesn't apply to the psul of Guzzle and the psul of of not being Lachem and all of those things. So it's a fascinating sugya. It's a great lamdisha topic. The other shaila is more thorny, meaning getting the person to come on Shabbos. So there's a broader topic in halacha, and again, just really, really be kitzur. There's a broader topic in halacha about inviting someone who's not religious, who's not Torah observant, to your home on Shabbos in a Torah observant environment, and whether that's a net positive or a negative. There are two extreme opinions, and then there's a middle opinion. One extreme opinion is Rav Moshe Feinstein, and this comes up most often when you're inviting someone for a Shabbos meal. Rabbi Neil Turk, who works on the sixth floor with me in Gluck in Yeshiva University, is quoted by Marina Rav Shachter Shlita in Nefesh HaRav, that when he had his first Rabbanus, he said most of the people were not Torah observant, and the only way to really connect with them was to invite them for Shabbos meals. And they would always drive. And he went to Rav Soloveitchik and said, I have a problem. He said, my biggest problem that I have in my Rabbanus is to figure out how to do this, how to invite them for Shabbos. And Rav Soloveitchik said to him, you don't have a problem, there's no problem. It's usher, you can't do it. Meaning, that's it. You're not allowed to. That's not a problem. It's usher. There's nothing to talk about. Similar to that, Rav Moshe Feinstein was also of that extreme position that it's absolutely usher to invite someone who's going to drive on Shabbos, and that it's not lifnei iver, it's worse. It's a violation of an iser mesis. That mesis is when you provoke someone into an aveda. That you're provoking them to drive. They otherwise would have been perfectly happy to stay home. On the other extreme, you have Rav Moshe Sternbach, who was a Rav before he was the Gaivet of the Yed Charedis, or the Raivet of the Yed Charedis, I get confused with the titles, something big in the Yed Charedis, he was a Rav in South Africa. And in South Africa, at that time, if you were a religious Jew, you were a Baal Tshuva, meaning there was no such thing as a from birth religious Jew in South Africa at that time. So his entire Rabbanus was in dealing with shailas related to Balei Tshuva. He writes about this in his introduction to Tshuvas Van Hagos, and he says, of course you have to invite them for Shabbos. That it's going to be so much better than whatever they're doing at home. you're going to be able to provide them with a religious environment. You're going to be able to provide them with inspiration, this and that. In the middle, most poskim, I would say, are of the opinion that you have to give them the opportunity not to be Mechal Shabbos. So you invite them Friday night to come before Shabbos starts, and then you offer them your guest room, which often gets tricky, because often it's a couple that's not married, right? Or the woman is a nida or something because she doesn't use the mikveh, and you're going to offer them your guest room. You know, you can offer them to sleep together, and so you have to be careful about that also. But that's fairly common for people to offer the opportunity to stay, even though you know that they're going to turn it down. But to at least offer them that possibility, that's Mori Rabbi Shechter is of that opinion that you can do that. So would that apply over here? That's the question, because you're not inviting them to inspire them really. You're inviting them because they can take care of your kid. In the end of the day, being in a frum home on Shabbos, being in a Torah observant home on Shabbos, will be much more inspiring to them than sitting home and watching TV all Shabbos or whatever else they would be doing. You know, going out Friday night and partying, whatever else they would be doing, it will be a more inspiring thing. Now, the thing is, it's not a one-time thing where you're going to be saying, "Oh, come and sleep," and I'll offer you the opportunity to sleep over. It's going to be every week. You're employing them, and it's not just that you're doing this out of the kindness of your heart to give karev them, you're benefiting from it. Meaning it's very hard to know that you're really doing this to help them. So it is a little bit trickier. On the other hand, if you offer to have an Uber drive them back and forth, what are they really violating? So what they're violating is Amir al-Akum, right? Amir al-Akum is Asr, right? Rabbi Yisrael Reisman has a great line. He said, when I was a kid, Rabbi Reisman said, there used to be an Isser called Amir al-Akum. Now there's a Heter called Amir al-Akum. And anytime someone's asking, they say, oh no, Amir al-Akum, it's going to be Mutter. But there used to be that there was such a thing called an Isser of Amir al-Akum. So Amir al-Akum is Asr, but you're allowed to do Amir al-Akum for the sake of a Chol Hashem Bel Sakan. If the child, the special needs child, really is having trouble functioning and you really need the extra help to help the child out, it could be, depending on the details, that it's a Chol Hashem Bel Sakana. And that anyway it's mutter. Because to do Amir Lakum for the sake of Chol Hashem Bel Sakana might anyway be mutter.
Whether it's the case of the woman who's coming to help with the child, or if it's the case of someone who might go over for Shabbat meal, would there be a distinction of if the person is able to walk, but it's just choosing to drive? Or if you're inviting someone who lives over an hour, 2 hours by walk?
Definitely a distinction. If the person is able to walk, so it's much more helpful because you're not even asking them to drive. Meaning, within reason, you're asking them to walk. Look, you could say, oh, the person could walk 12 miles also, but you know that that's not going to happen. But if they live a couple of blocks away, it's a nice enough day, they might, you know, they might decide to walk.
Then would that be an issue with Ne'iver? If the person lives less than a mile, it's perfectly reasonable to walk, or because they just...
Right, much less of an issue of with Ne'iver, certainly not Mesis in such a case, L'chola. Yeah. It is worthwhile to, and a lot of the poskim say this, to let it be known that you'd be much more comfortable if they walk. Meaning not just to be so afraid of saying things. A lot of times religious Jews are afraid of saying things because I don't want to be off-putting. I don't want to say, there's a way, if you say something sincerely and nicely, usually Dvar Mayotzi Min Alev or Nechnasim Al Alev. And if you say something in the proper way, but you can say that, you know, it pains me so much, you know, that, you know, or it's just... It makes us uncomfortable when people are driving on Shabbos to the extent that... So sometimes that will mean they'll park a block away, you know, and then walk the rest of the way. Okay, but that's also sensitivity. At least they're thinking of that.
A little bit off topic, but how many parents does the Rebbe advise that a guy should learn enough before he continues on to the next
daf? I think it depends on the guy, it depends on the daf. It depends on a lot of things.
General.
Meaning... These are difficult questions because, first of all, it always makes me feel like a hypocrite because whatever I answer is not something that I actually do, because I know that what I'm doing is not what I should be doing, because I'm always trying to catch up because I have the next year to give and the next whatever. But all of our gedolim say that no matter how bright you are, no matter how brilliant you are, that chazara is everything. It's not like Rav Vadya Yosef learned through Shas once and then said, okay, I know it already. You know, I learned it already. I don't need to. He didn't forget, right? He very rarely forgot things, So why did he keep learning Gemara? But because there's deeper understanding each time, you pick up on more nuances each time. Osios machkimos. I would say that at the very least, before you move on to the next daf, you should at least be able to map out what that daf was about. If someone were to ask you, what was the daf about today? What was that? You know, what you learned in the morning for 3 hours? What were the topics discussed? If you can't, even if you could read every word and you can look back and know what every word says, if you can't like immediately say, oh, there were two or three topics, and this was, you know, there was a machlokas between Rabbi and Abaye, and Rabbi said this, and Abaye attacked him four times, or whatever. You know, just to be able to say, like, the basics, then for sure, you can't move on. There is great, great value in learning things more in depth, and not only learning things superficially. Daf Yomi, by its very nature, is a little more superficial, a lot more superficial, unless you're spending, you know, 12 hours a day on the daf. I think it should be a complement to some other learning that's being done in a more profound way. I'm finding recently, based on the emails I'm getting and the questions I'm getting from people who listen to Daf Yomi, that when your only learning is on a very superficial level, it very often leads to a corruption of the Gemara, that people so don't understand it that they corrupt it and turn it into things that it's not. So it's important to appreciate, getting an appreciation for Torah Shavuta by learning with great pekius. I'll tell you, I was reading recently Rav Meir Tversky's Hesped for a Salvation. They just printed it, so you saw he was discussing about Brisker Lumdus, you know, and how in Brisk it's all about the Iyun and the Lumdus, and how people make this mistake to think that that Briskers completely ignore Bekius, that they ignore a broad base of knowledge and things like that. And Rav Meir Tversky said, they're misunderstanding. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to learn 2 Svarim a day, he would learn 60 blot in those 2 Svarim a day. Rav Kook would learn 60 blot a day, Rav Shachter always tells. So what they're misunderstanding is, What Brisk was Mechadesh was that knowing everything is not the definition of Godless, it's the prerequisite to Godless. It's impossible to have Godless if you don't know everything, but that's where Godless begins. Once you know everything, then what do you do with it, and how do you build it, and how do you develop that that knowledge? Which is also a fascinating insight. Okay, I don't want to go up against...
One last question.
Whenever we have
I assume you asked Rav Shechter.
Yes, everybody's topic. It's one of those things like Rav Shechter can ask the speakers at the end.
Yeah. I'm afraid because I don't know if I'm going to say the same thing as Rav Shechter. In my second sefer, I wrote about poppers, essentially. I wrote about breaded chicken. Rav Nevensal holds, and I think it makes a lot of sense, that the breading that a lot of the poskim think you only say a shahakal on the chicken because the chicken is so much an ikker is when it's such a thin layer of breading that it's just to make sure the thing doesn't burn in the frying pan. But when it's a thick breading that adds flavor and food quality to it, and you know, when it's really something and it's not just like a chunk of chicken that you get in a, you know, Chinese place or whatever, it's it really adds a food, a crunch and a food quality to it. So I Rav Nevensal is of the opinion that there's a rule, kol sheyesh bo mechamesh minei dagan, and the Gemara says kol sheyesh bo mechamesh minei dagan, the brachas bar minei mezonos, and that would therefore fit into that rule. It would not be an exception to that rule. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Right. So a wrap, a frankenblank is a little bit different because it's a flaky dough.
Let's say the wrap.
So a wrap is generally made to be eaten as a meal. You're just supposed to eat two of them, you know, both sides, you know, after they split it. So, you know, it seems like it seems to me to be bread.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you all. Thank you very much.